Hello and welcome to the second episode of Solitaire Rose Radio. That's right, the spin-off from Crazy Comics and Stories featuring me, Corey Strode, otherwise known as your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. This is the podcast where I get more into telling the stories behind comics, the stories around comics, maybe stories that don't have to do with comics. Today's stories have to do with comics, but first I want to talk a little about the first episode. I got some nice feedback. One person sent me a message saying that they enjoyed it, that they liked the look at history, they liked the varied thing. They were surprised I was able to go on so long, and they aren't the only one. Got a few tweets and texts and stuff saying that the audio quality wasn't very good. Well, I'm using a different audio mixer this time, so hopefully it will sound better. I was using Skype's audio mixer for solo podcasts and was amazed at how poor the sound came out. And since I didn't want to re-record the whole thing, I decided just go with what I got. Hopefully this will sound better. More feedback is highly, highly, highly appreciated. Solo podcasts especially thrive on feedback, so if you have any feedback, please email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. You can follow me on the fire-breathing Twitter machine, where I am at Solitaire Rose. You can also check me out on the Facebook, where I am known as Corey Strode. There is also a Solitaire Rose Radio fan page. You can sign up for that. You could call me. You can leave a message. I have the Google voicemail all set up at 952-856-0519. And if you leave a message, I will play it on the air. I will answer your questions on the air. I think that's all the housekeeping. Oh, yes, we have an ad. This show is sponsored by the great people at DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is actually having a convention this year. They're setting up a convention for their users, and I don't have a lot of details about it because they just announced it a couple of days ago. But they're having a convention. They say you can come and you can meet other people who have DreamHost websites. You can go to seminars about how best to use their features. You can talk with people who work at DreamHost about issues and problems you're having. That's just another way that they show that they're dedicated to customer service. If you need a website, and you do, because you probably want to have a blog, or you want to have your own podcast, or you want to have a web strip, or you want to have a traditional web page, or you've got a store you want to set up online, just go to DreamHost.com, put in the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, and you'll save $20 off your first year. And unlike most things, their prices aren't going down, but their service and what they give you goes up every year. I have yet to have a price increase, and every year they give me more bandwidth and more storage space and more features and more things. It's a wonderful, wonderful place to have your website. For the second episode of Solitaire Rose Radio, I want to talk about Jack Kirby. Now, those of you who are comic fans, you've heard of Jack Kirby. Those of you who aren't comic fans, you may have heard of Jack Kirby. You should have, however. Usually when Jack Kirby is mentioned, they talk about how he was an artist at Marvel and other places, and he created the Fantastic Four and Captain America and the X-Men and on down the line, the Hulk, all the Inhumans, Galactus, the Silver Surfer, Warlock, all these wonderful characters. You could pretty much say that the Silver Age of Marvel was built on Jack Kirby's creations. Yes, there was a lot of stuff Ditko did for Spider-Man and Doctor Strange, but those characters pretty much just stayed in Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. The Kirby characters went everywhere. And he created so many that you can't throw a rock in Silver Age Marvel without hitting a Jack Kirby character. But I'm going to go in a little deeper. I'm recording this on February 7th. And yesterday was the 19th anniversary of the death of Jack Kirby. He died on February 6, 1964. He was 76 years old. He was born on August 28, 1917. And his name was not Jack Kirby when he was born. It was Jacob Katzberg. I was introduced to Jack Kirby twice. And yes, I'm stealing that from Mark Evanier's beautiful book, Kirby, King of Comics, which is still available. I've actually seen it on some remainder bookshelves. So as one of the Kirby biographies, highly, highly recommended. Mark Evanier worked for Kirby for a number of years and was very close with him pretty much from when he started working for him until Jack passed. But at the end of it, he talks about he met Kirby twice. I, too, met Jack Kirby twice. The first time was when I was a kid and was just starting to pick up comics on my own. I'd been reading comics since I was basically, I'd always had comic books in my life. But when I turned 12, I decided that I wanted to try the superhero books that everybody on the bus was talking about. They were really talking about Marvel books. And I've said in the past that the first Marvel comic I picked up was Marvel Tales number 59, which was a reprint book, a Spider-Man reprint book, and I didn't know it was a reprint. The next book I picked up was Marvel's Greatest Comics, and it was the story Worlds Within Worlds, a reprint of a 60s Fantastic Four story. And it was written by Stan Lee and drawn by Jack Kirby. And the story was that the Galactus hungered. And he had come back to Earth to take the Silver Surfer, who he had banished to Earth, to have the Silver Surfer find him a suitable planet to destroy and absorb the cosmic energies of. And the Surfer no longer wanted to do that. He no longer wanted to lead Galactus to populated worlds where people would die. And since he couldn't escape the Earth, he decided to go inward, and he shrank to a multiverse to escape Galactus. And I remember I enjoyed the Spider-Man comic. It was a good, solid adventure story with a lot of drama and angst. And it was the first superhero book that I read and liked, because when I was young, I was what they called a sensitive child. Godzilla movies would freak me out. Horror movies would freak me out to no end. And the art in superhero comics when I was a small child, I didn't like it because the colors were darker. There was shading, the drawing was more realistic, and I thought, oh, that's dark and scary. So I stuck with Archie and Harvey books, which were like little Richie Rich, Casper, Little Dot, things like that. And of course, the Disney Duck books. Everybody read the Disney Duck books. But I decided at 12 that I was going to read the superhero books, and Spider-Man was good. But then the Fantastic Four just blew my mind. You had all these characters running around. You had all this action, all these ideas being thrown at you. You know, imagine you pick up a comic book. Here's the Fantastic Four. Oh, now here's the Silver Surfer. Oh, here's Galactus. Oh, now here's a microverse with all this stuff going on. And just boom, 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 it's being thrown at you. And they edited the books down, so it was only 17 pages. But it was 17 pages at this manic, breakneck speed, with action and fights, and everything seemed to be moving and happening all at once. And that's when I was hooked. That's when I became a superhero fan. I became a Marvel Comics fan. And I became a Jack Kirby fan. And later on, when I found out that these were reprints, I didn't much care, because then it was, I'm getting to read the really early stuff at Marvel. I'm getting to read where all this stuff came from. And the books weren't even 10 years old But to me, it was, oh, these are classics. And it was around the same time that Marvel started advertising, Kirby is coming back. So I was just in heaven. I'm going to get to read new Jack Kirby stuff and the original Jack Kirby stuff. And that's how I met Jack Kirby. I met his art. I met him through his art. Then, in 1985, I went to the Chicago Comic Book Convention, which at the time, it and San Diego were around the same size. San Diego wasn't the monster that it became over the last few years, but the two big conventions in the 80s were San Diego and Chicago. And I went to the Chicago Comic Con. I went for all 3 days. And on one of the days, well, it was DC's 50th anniversary. And you know, they were going all out. They had a spokesmodel dressed as Wonder Woman. They had everyone involved in most of the big stuff. Dick Giordano was there, who was the... DC didn't really have an editor-in-chief, but he was kind of the lead editor. And Jack Kirby was there. And Kirby was there to promote his Hunger Dogs graphic novel. And he was in the middle of a fight with Marvel about returning his original art. So there was a lot of passion around it. A lot of controversy around what was being done with Kirby. And DC had swooped in and said, hey, would you like to finish your New Gods saga? We're going to, yep, you can have a 72-page story in the reprints we do, and then do a graphic novel to wrap it all up. And he was there to promote that. And I was in awe of most of it, because, as I've said, I'm just this farm boy from Fairview, Illinois. Yeah, the sign says there are 350 people in the town, but it's more like 250. And we didn't even live in town. We lived a couple miles outside of town. Far enough outside of town that I was not allowed to ride my mini bike into town. Not that there was anything in town to ride your mini bike to. And there was Jack Kirby, and he was talking with Dick Giordano at the DC banner. They weren't at the table, they were at the banner. And I remember it was toward the end of the day. And I had to work up the nerve to talk to him. I've talked in the past, to me, comic book creators were the way other people saw rock stars. So imagine you're a fan of Bruce Springsteen, and you're at a hotel, and Bruce Springsteen's just kind of standing there talking to somebody. And your whole life, you've gone to his concerts, you bought every one of his records, you go out, you buy the bootlegs, you buy any magazine that has him on the cover, and there he is. That's how I felt with Jack Kirby. And I was very intimidated, and very overwhelmed, and finally I worked up the nerve, and I just went up to him and said, Mr. Kirby, I know that a lot of people say that they're your biggest fan. I'm not your biggest fan, but I love your work. I've been following your work since I first read it. And I just want to thank you for all the wonderful stories you did. And he was very gracious and very kind, and he shook my hand, and we talked for a little bit about the New Gods, and you know, it was my first time reading it, and I was so just blown away by it. And as we ended the conversation, he said, you know, a lot of people come up to me and say that I've influenced them, and they love my art, but it's really rare that somebody thanks me. So you're welcome. And I've since learned that Jack was very gracious to fans. In some ways a little too gracious to fans, which we'll talk about as we go on. I have other stories about how Jack Kirby, we were looking to invite him to the Minneapolis Comic Book Convention back in the early 90s while he was still alive. And there were some people who rather forcibly said, no, we don't want Jack Kirby. He's rude, he's a jerk, etc., etc., etc. And I'm not going to name the names of those people. But I'll tell you this. Everything I've learned since then is that those people were unbelievably wrong. And it's one of my regrets that we didn't get Jack Kirby to come to our convention before he passed away. Jacob Katzberg was born August 28, 1917. His parents were immigrants on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. They were Austrian Jewish immigrants, and his father worked as a garment factory worker. They were very poor, as were most of the people who lived in the neighborhood that Jack grew up in. And Jack himself talked a lot in interviews, and he did a story, which is available in the Kirby book by Evanier. It's also available in a book by Tomorrow's. It's been printed in a few places, called Street Code, where he draws a story. He drew it in the early 80s, but he drew a story about what it was like for him growing up. He was in street gangs. And not the kind of street gangs we think about where, you know, it's a way to sell drugs or do this. No, it was a street gang. They protected their street, their block, their neighborhood. And they would get into fights with other gangs that were protecting their block and their neighborhood. And the only reason I bring that up is, as you go through Kirby's life, you see that he had this tough exterior, and he was never scared to get into a scrap if he felt that somebody was being wronged. Jack would defend the little guy. He was a big proponent of, you know, you have to stop the bullies. And it shows through in his work. Jack wasn't a tall guy. I believe he was only 5'6" when I met him. I was very surprised at how short he was. But he was tough, and he came across, especially in his younger years, as kind of the short, angry New York guy. When you look at his work, there's all in his kid gangs, there's always that kid from New York who's the tough scrapper. Kirby always saw himself as the Thing. When he would draw the Thing, he felt like it was almost autobiographical. Now, along with this, Jack was self-taught how to draw. He drew on everything. Every scrap of paper that was brought home, he drew on. And his parents could not afford drawing paper. So what his father did was he would buy a roll of butcher paper. And Jack would just draw on it and draw on it and draw on it and draw on it until, you know, he'd used up it all and then he got more. He was a big fan of comic strips. He said that his influences were Milton Caniff, Hal Foster, Alex Raymond. He was also a big fan of editorial cartoons. So he had this all growing up. He was rejected by the Educational Alliance. He was in school, and they saw the art talent, so they tried to send him to a place called the Educational Alliance, and Kirby said that he was rejected for that because he drew too fast. By the time he was 14, he was drawing cartoons for the newspaper The Boys' Brotherhood Republic, which was kind of a street gang, except it was more set up like a government, and they put out a newspaper of what was going on in the neighborhood, and Kirby was the staff artist. This was before he was 14. At 14, he was enrolled at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, and he quit. According to him, it's because he saw that they wanted you to work on things very studiously and very much taking your time. And he was all about speed. He'd get the drawing done and want to be on to the next thing. This really feeds into how he drew through his life. So this ability to draw rapidly and this need to move on to the next thing. You know, I'm done, I'm moving on. Was kind of always there. Always a part of his life. So he was working by the time he was 14, not just in art, but he also had other jobs in order to help bring money into the family. And you got to remember, back then there weren't a lot of child labor laws, so Jack was doing a lot of stuff. Any of the kids in the family, once they hit about 14, 15, they were expected to start bringing in money. His father didn't make a lot of money. In 1936, he kind of got his first art job, and he joined a company called Lincoln Newspaper Syndicate. And he did newspaper strips and advice cartoons and editorial cartoons. And what Lincoln Newspaper Syndicate would do was, they were kind of a third or fourth tier syndicate. So they had strips that, if you can't afford this popular strip, we've got a knockoff. There are some examples of this. I remember on the Kirby list when Greg Theakson, who was an art assistant and inker and colorer for Kirby. Matter of fact, if you go and pick up your copy of The New Gods and flip back to The Hunger Dogs, Theakson's the one who worked on that. Theakson's also the guy who was heavily involved in decolorizing a lot of Golden Age reprints before computers were able to do that. I've never met him. I've chatted with him a number of times. He's a wonderful guy, has a lot of information about Jack. He also wrote a two-part biography of Jack Kirby that he self-published through Pure Imagination, but those books are currently sold out. So if you'll have to look for them at your comic shop, but I really doubt you're going to find them, because they were probably, I know Greg just printed to order. And I imagine a lot of comic shops did not order them unless they had somebody who had already said they were going to buy them. Kirby did a lot of knockoff strips. They were almost like popular comic strips. As I was talking about when Theakson sent them to the Kirby mailing list, the one that we all fixated on and we all loved, and we actually made him the mascot for the Kirby discussion list on Yahoo, was Socko the Sea Dog. If you couldn't afford Popeye, you'd get Socko the Sea Dog, who was just as rough and tumble. And there are only a few strips of these remaining, so you don't know what the stories are, but it was a lot like Popeye in that there was an adventure, but the strip would end with a joke. And when you look at it, you can see that real early motion and action that Kirby would draw. The page that has been circulated the most has four different strips that Kirby did. Kirby drew all of them, but he drew them under different names. Let's see, The Black Buccaneer, which was a pirate strip by Jack Curtis. Jack Curtis was also the name he used for the editorial cartoons he did and for the feature called Your Health Comes First. He also did one, Laughs from Today's News, which were kind of single panel strips. Your Health Comes First was health tips. You know, you don't catch a cold from going outside without a hat. You catch a cold from viruses, so wash your hands, that sort of thing. Laughs from Today's News were jokes and puns about what was going on in the news at that time. Let's see. Cyclone Burke by Bob Brown was about a fighter pilot, but it was also kind of a science fiction-y strip, because in the examples they have, he was a fighter pilot who fought robots. There's Abdul Jones by Ted Gray, which was a humor strip, a teenage boy who's thought of as a Maharaja in Saudi Arabia, and Socko the Sea Dog. Those are the ones where we have the most examples of. So if you couldn't afford any of the big name strips, and you couldn't afford the second tier strips, it's kind of like, if you can't afford Flash Gordon, you're going to get Buck Rogers. And if you can't afford Buck Rogers, you're going to go to Lincoln National. Now, Kirby did this for a while. There is no information at all about whether any of the regular comic strips were published in newspapers. There's no record of it, probably because a lot of the newspapers that published them were kind of low rent operations and didn't keep microfiche. And Lincoln National didn't last very long. They went away, and their records are lost to history. One thing also about Jack is that his memory, while better than Stan Lee's, was still not very good and could be influenced by the fact that he's told the story so many times. In the infamous 1985 Fantagraphics interview that he did with the Comics Journal at the height of his battle with Marvel, he would start to tell a story and his wife Roz would interrupt and correct him, and he would go, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So a lot of the stuff we have about Kirby's very early life is tainted by the fact that he didn't have the best memory in the world. Kirby's next art job after Lincoln National was an animation studio called Fleischer Studios, which you may know of as the people who did the Popeye cartoons, the people who did the Superman cartoons. They also did, I think it was the second animated feature. Disney did the first with Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. They did the second with Gulliver's Travels. And last fall, Turner Classic Movie did a whole night of Fleischer Studio stuff, the stuff that you don't have, the stuff that's not as circulated. You know, their feature film. Actually, they did two feature films, but the only one Turner showed, and the only one I've seen, is Gulliver's Travels. Some of the more obscure cartoons they did. Their studio was actually in New York. They were one of the few movie-making concerns still in New York by the end of the 30s. And Jack got a job there doing what was known as in-betweening. You had the main animators who would draw the main photo, the main animation cells. And Kirby would be one of the artists who would draw the transition. There were 12 frames a second. The main animators would draw two of the frames, and the in-betweeners would draw, you know, the six frames in between. Once Kirby got there, he wanted to go up the ladder. He would do extra work. When he walked in the door, he wanted to be one of the main animators, and they told him that you had to have more experience, so he took the in-betweening job, but he also would do stuff around the office. He would do extra jobs. He would start doing backgrounds. He would try to move up the ladder as fast as he could, because the farther up you are the ladder, the more money you make, the more money he could bring home to his family, who he still lived with. So he's working at this animation studio at between the age of 21 and 23. So he's working there in 1939. Fleischer announces that they're going to be moving out to Hollywood. Jack, who was still living with his parents and didn't have enough money to get a place on his own, had to look for work. And he found it in the growing comic book world. He first got a job with the Will Eisner and Iger Studio. And what it is, they were a firm at the time who would create stories and art for comic books, and they would go to the publishers and go, here's the stuff we have, do you want to publish any of this? They didn't publish it, but they would package books for publishers. He also did one-page strips, much like what they did at the Lincoln Newspaper Syndicate. Again, there were a lot of strips that he did that were put into early comics, and I believe it's fuzzy because I've done some research and I've seen both, that the strips were put in newspapers and the strips were sold to comic books, and at the time it could have been both. That they would take the comic strips he'd done and put them in the comic books. It's at this time that while he was working for Will Eisner and Iger, that he took the name Jack Kirby because it reminded him of the actor James Cagney. Now, he didn't do it because he was trying to hide that he was Jewish with Katzberg. He took it because Jack Kirby sounded like more of a... It sounded like a better name for what he wanted to do, and most artists at the time would take pseudonyms. They would take a name to not really cover up what they were doing, but so that, okay, I have this name, I'm Jack Kirby. Oh, there's a job over here. Well, I don't want this employer to know, so I'll use a different name. Which comes into effect very soon. He worked for the Iger Studio, and in Will Eisner's book, The Dreamer, which is a very, very, very thinly veiled autobiography, he has a Jack Kirby story. Kirby was one of the artists there, and Kirby, of course, at Eisner Iger, was unbelievably fast. Kirby was always fast. But he's working there, and he's one of the fastest artists they have. And there was one day where a not very reputable person who worked for a not very reputable group brought in a water cooler and told Eisner and Iger that you will be buying water from us. We have a fountain over there. No, you're going to be buying water from us, and we'll be coming in this many times a week, and you're going to pay us this much for this water. And they were scared to do anything about it. You know, basically, it's kind of the old protection racket, except it's, no, you're going to be buying water rather than you're going to be buying protection, because you don't want something bad to happen to your art studio here. When Kirby found out about it, the next time the guy came up, Kirby took his, I think it's the tea rule, and went over and had a talk with the gentleman that this will not happen again, and he better not see this guy. And if this guy shows up again, Kirby's going to beat the snot out of him. And he took the water cooler and he left. How accurate is this story? Well, Eisner put it in his autobiography, and Eisner was one of these guys, he well known for having a very good memory. Kirby was a scrapper. Now, he continued to work there, and it was at this time that he and his family moved into Brooklyn, and there he met Rosalind. Roz Goldstein. Now, she lived in the same apartment building, and she lived upstairs. And when they were seeing each other, what it would be, Jack would go upstairs and have dinner with their family, and they would sit and they would talk, and he would tell about, you know, well, I used to work in animation, now I work in comic books. And Roz often told the story where when the early times they met, Jack said, would you like to come down to our apartment and see my etchings? Which was kind of code for, hey, want to come down to my apartment and make out for a while? And Roz was surprised that when she went down there, he really had etchings. His bedroom was just filled with drawings. And all the stuff that he'd done in the past that he was able to keep the art for. And so they had a courtship. It was also at this time that Kirby moved on from the Eisner Iger studio to Fox Feature Syndicate. He was making $15 a week drawing comics. He drew a newspaper strip that was in the papers. And this comic strip was called The Blue Beetle. Kirby drew The Blue Beetle. He drew it as a newspaper strip that was then cut up and put into a comic book for Fox Features. And that's the same Blue Beetle that is now owned at DC. He drew these stories of Dan Garrett. And then when Fox went under, it went to Holyoke Publishing. And when Holyoke went under, it went to Carlton Comics. And then Carlton Comics sold it to DC. And DC changed it to... Actually, it was Carlton that kind of changed it to Ted Kord. But yeah, it's the same Blue Beetle that's still in print today, and features the adventures of Jaime Reyes. Now, while Jack was working at Fox Features, which was owned by, let me look the guy's name up. Fox Features was owned by Victor S. Fox. And Victor S. Fox was very famous for one thing and one thing only. He was a horrible, horrible boss. When you worked for him, you got $15 a week, whether you put out 20 pages a week or 10 pages a week. And he had rows of drawing tables. And the artist would be there, and he would be puffing a big old cigar as he walked up and down the aisle, making sure that you were drawing, your drawings were good, and you were drawing what you were supposed to, and you weren't freelancing or moonlighting for anybody else. But he would walk up and down the aisles, puffing his old cigar, and every so often he'd go, "I'm king of the comics! I'm the king of the comics!" So remember old Victor Fox puffing up and down the aisle, calling himself the king of the comics, while Jack Kirby worked for him. Jack met the cartoonist and editor, Joe Simon. Now Simon, he was the editor for Victor Fox. He oversaw a bunch of the books. He would take part in drawing, he would do inking, he would do writing, he would fix scripts. And he saw Kirby's art, and he loved Kirby's art, but more than that, he loved how fast Kirby could draw. Now, Joe Simon was freelancing at night because he didn't feel that he was making enough money, and there was also kind of a feeling that this comic boom might not last, so you better get all the money out of it you can. You know, while this stuff's selling, strike while the iron's hot. Simon loved his work. They worked together on a few books, and then they decided to go out on their own. And at this point, Simon kind of became the business guy. Kirby was the artist, and Simon was the business guy. The way they did art was much more complicated than comic book art now. Jack would draw some stuff, and Simon would draw some stuff, and Jack would ink some things, and Joe would ink some things, and if they were running late, they would trade pages back and forth to get stuff done. It was a true partnership, but in the partnership, Joe Simon was the guy who did all the business stuff, and he got in touch with Martin Goodman, who was a publisher, what was then known as Timely Comics. He was a pulp publisher who'd started to get into publishing comic books, and he was working through the studio Funnies Incorporated. Funnies Incorporated was the one who put together everything that's in Marvel Comics number one, like Submariner, Human Torch, all the characters that are in that, and Marvel Mystery going forward. However, Goodman didn't much care for Funnies Incorporated because he felt that he could cut out the middleman. You know, why am I paying this company to pay artists and writers when I could just pay artists and writers? And Joe Simon went to him and said, "You know what? Jack and I will put books together for you that you can sell. We'll charge less." And in charging Martin Goodman less, they would actually make more because they're cutting out the middleman as well. The first book they put together for Martin Goodman was that massive hit that everybody knows, The Red Raven. You say you haven't heard of The Red Raven. Well, that doesn't surprise me. There was one issue of The Red Raven. And sales figures were very hard to come by back then. So really nobody knows. It was thought of at the time as a huge flop, because they only did one issue. And the urban legend is that Martin Goodman, when the books would come out, he would go around to the different newsstands in New York City, and whatever he saw that sold out, he would make more of. And whatever he saw that there was a bunch on the shelf, he'd get rid of and start new. So the urban legend is, as he was walking around town, he saw a lot of The Red Raven on the stands. Well, that's not selling. Canceled it. Second issue came out, and it was Human Torch. That's why there's no Human Torch number one. It's Human Torch number two. Red Raven was the first issue. Their next idea was Captain America. Now, there were other patriotic heroes at the time. MLJ, which became Archie Publications, had the Shield. But Captain America was wrapped in the flag. His costume was based on the American flag. But the other thing about Captain America was he instantly, this was in 1940, he instantly was the fought Nazis, which may not seem like a big deal now to us, but 1940, a year before Pearl Harbor, when there were still businesses that were still doing business with the Nazis, there were still a lot of support for Hitler in the U.S. because Hitler was fighting the communists. And we hated the communists. Through the Depression, there was a lot of worry that because of the Depression, people were thinking capitalism has failed, communism will work. And business owners were petrified of communism. But workers who had been let down by capitalism and let down by the business community and were out of work and unable to find work, and whatever work there was temporary and low paying, the idea of communism really got a lot of traction, and there was a lot of fear of it among the business elite. So if you look at business leaders in the U.S. in the 30s especially, I'm not going to say that they thought of Hitler as a hero, but they did think this is a guy who could stop communism. There also, we know much more about what was going on inside Germany. At the time, the Jewish subculture in the U.S. was hearing stories about Jews being rounded up. But it wasn't... what was going on wasn't really known. Hitler's people were propaganda masters. So here you've got Captain America. Here's this guy wrapped in a flag, the cover of his first issue, punching Hitler in the face. And the book was a huge, huge hit. It was Timely's best-selling book by far. They could not print enough copies. They would send out more copies and they would all sell. They'd get very, very few back from the newsstand. And the way newsstand worked is you would ship your copies out to the distributor, who would take them to the newsstands. And then after they'd been on sale for a month, they would return the ones that didn't sell and get credit for it. And you based how well something sold by what percentage of books sold. Superman sold a lot. Captain Marvel sold more. Batman sold a lot. Captain America was Timely's best-selling book by far. There was also something different in the art. If you look at those early issues, you see Kirby's style. It's right there, fully formed. You know, his art changed over the years, but his superhero style was right there. Figures were always in motion. Captain America was busting through panel borders. That wasn't done because people thought of comic books as, well, you draw it like a comic strip. And in comic strips, every panel's this, and you do this. Matter of fact, if you look at the early Superman comic stories in action, you'll see that each panel is numbered. And they're all uniform, except for maybe a splash panel. They're all uniform because it had been drawn as a comic strip, and they cut up the art to put it in a comic book page rather than a comic strip. Kirby drew entire pages. People have said that what he would do when he would sit down to draw, up until the day he quit drawing, he would have the blank page, and rather than, okay, I'm going to draw in the border, I'm going to draw the action, and then draw in the panel borders. Nope. Kirby started in one corner, and he just started drawing, and he would draw till he got to the bottom of the page. Then he would go in, he would draw the panel borders, and move on to the next page. His art was different from anything else on the stands. Simon and Kirby instantly became the top guys in comics. They were in demand. Captain America was selling through the roof. Kirby's art was different. It was exciting. Yeah, there was a crude energy to it. And it changed how superhero books were drawn. If you look at the DC stuff that they've reprinted in the DC archives, you can almost tell pre-Kirby and post-Kirby. Because the pre-Kirby stuff, very stiff, very posed, very much the action is in the very center of the frame of each panel. Kirby had stuff going on. Everything was in motion. Everything was moving. Even then, he was using foreshortening to make it look like stuff was coming at you. He was learning page construction. You'd get to the bottom of the page, and there'd be a mini cliffhanger to get you to the next page. And on like that. Captain America was a huge hit. Simon and Kirby did other stories and such for Timely. If you look back in your Marvel Mystery masterworks, Kirby did the Vision, which was a otherworldly god who came to judge and came to judge the wicked. As part of the deal with Captain America, Goodman said that Simon and Kirby would get 15% of the profits and salaried positions. Simon would be the company's editor, and Kirby would be the art director for the whole company. It was a deal put together by Joe Simon. So they released the first issue of Captain America Comics. Wikipedia says it was released in early 1941. No, it came out December of 1940. Because it was a big deal. And it sold out within days. They did the second issue. They printed over 1 million copies for everything that was said at the time. It sold out as well. It was by far the number one book. Now, as they were doing Captain America, they were also working for other companies. The first issue of Captain Marvel was mostly drawn by Simon and Kirby. It was drawn in the house style because Captain Marvel had been in Wiz Comics and C.C. Beck had developed an art style. And the people who worked for him all drew in that style. Wiz Comics was doing so well that they wanted to get a Captain Marvel comic on the stands immediately. And Beck was already overwhelmed. So they brought in Simon and Kirby to draw that first issue. Except they couldn't call themselves Simon and Kirby. It was signed C.C. Beck. By the 10th issue of Captain America, the relationship between Goodman and Simon and Kirby had soured. Goodman was, I've talked in other podcasts, Goodman was one of the sleazier of the sleazy publishers. And yes, Simon and Kirby had a deal that they would get 15% of the profit. But much like a Hollywood studio did, Goodman relied on creative accounting. Goodman would charge all the office supplies to Captain America. He would charge office expenses to Captain America. And it would take a cut out of the profits. So Joe Simon felt that they were being ripped off. And Kirby always got very angry when he felt like he was being ripped off. So Joe Simon said, no, we're not going to confront him. We're just going to go and we're going to find other work. Now at the time, there was a young man who was kind of an office assistant. Stanley Lieber. And he was Martin Goodman's nephew. Not directly a nephew, kind of a second-hand nephew, who was looking for work and hadn't been able to keep a job anywhere else, so they brought him in to run errands in the office. And he was the guy who, okay, lunchtime, he'd run off and get the sandwiches. Kirby needs more paper, so he'd bring Kirby more paper. This guy needs more ink, so he'd be filling the ink things. He was kind of the office guy, and one of the things he would do that would annoy the shit out of everybody, he had an ocarina, and when he didn't have anything to do, he'd kind of jump up on one of the file cabinets and play the ocarina. And he wanted to get into writing, so what Simon and Kirby did is, okay, you could write the text features. And what the text features were, if you look at old comics, up till I would say up till the 70s. They would always have a two-page text feature. It would either be a letters page, in Marvel and DC's case, or a short story. And do yourself a favor and don't read any of the short stories. I've tried to read the ones even in EC Comics, which were, you know, the pinnacle of art in the 50s. The short stories are just terrible. And what it was, okay, we have to have 2 pages of text so that we can be considered a magazine and get the second-class magazine mailing rate instead of having sent it first class. So they would put these 2 pages of text in order to save money. So Stan wanted to be a writer. They said, okay, you can write the text feature. And I believe it's in Captain America 4, Stan Lee's first published writing. And it's a text story about Captain America. Simon and Kirby were fielding other offers, and they were able to get a deal at National Comics, which you know now as DC Comics. And they would get a combined $500 a week, whereas at Martin Goodman's, Simon got $75, Kirby got $85, and they shared the profits from Captain America, which they weren't really getting. So they were keeping the deal a secret until they got everything done so that they could finish up what they were doing before their contract with National started. And this is where one of the bones of contention for Jack Kirby and Stan Lee started. Because Martin Goodman found out, Simon and Kirby blamed it on Stan Lee. They said that Stan ratted him out. Stan said he had nothing to do with it. He had been sworn to secrecy and he didn't tell anybody. They blamed him. They finished up their work on Captain America number 10 and they went to National. Now, one of the things Marvel published in the early 90s that is one of my treasured possessions is a slipcase called Captain America the Early Years, and it reprints all the Simon and Kirby Captain America stuff from those first 10 issues. They then put it out in paperback a while back. They've since gone back and put it out as Masterworks, and in the Masterworks they have all the stories because Simon and Kirby just did the Captain America stuff. They had other people doing the other features, which I didn't pick up the Masterworks because I spent $75 when this slipcase came out. I'm not going to spend $75 each for Captain America 1 through 4, Captain America 4 through 8, Captain America 9 through 12. I did pick up the 9 through 12, but I didn't want to, I don't want to spend the money again, especially when I'm probably not ever going to read the non-Kirby stories. And truth is, in the Masterwork 9, 10, 11, and 12, I did read the non-Kirby stories, and They're typical Golden Age stuff. But those Kirby stories, they're just fun. They're so fun. And the funny thing is about those stories, when they brought Captain America back in the 60s, and they didn't quite know what to do with them, Lee and Kirby kind of rewrote those stories and did them again. And they did that for a while till they figured out what they wanted to do with the Captain America feature in the 60s. So, Simon and Kirby go over to National Comics. One of the reasons they kept it quiet, because Goodman was still paying them some royalties, but he wasn't paying them all, and they thought if Goodman found out, he'd stiff him on the royalties. He found out. He did stiff him on the royalties. It was a basis for a lawsuit with Joe Simon in the 60s, which we'll get to when we get to the 60s. So, Simon and Kirby go over to National, and they were told, just do what you want. Now, they tried ghosting some other strips, drawing in other people's styles, kind of doing what people had done before, and nobody was happy about that arrangement. The editors at DC weren't happy about it. Simon and Kirby weren't happy about it. The publisher said, look, just do what you want and we'll print it. We've seen how popular Captain America is. We trust you. We've seen how popular Captain America is. We saw how popular the Young Allies is. We've seen how popular your other features are. We trust you. Do what you want. Now, the thing is, while the publisher trusted them, the editors at DC did not. They didn't like it. The editors at DC were very much control freaks. And they didn't like the fact that this writer-artist team had been brought in and was kind of creating their own stuff. They had strong editorial presence. If you look at the DC books, even early on, you take a look at the earliest Superman stories and then take a look at the Superman stories 3 years later. Vastly different, because DC editorial had come in and said, all right, you're not going to do any more stories about Superman fighting evil landlords and doing things and corrupt mine owners, and we don't want Captain America to be the New Deal superhero anymore. He's going to fight mad scientists, and he's going to fight monsters, and he's going to do these things rather than the wish fulfillment stuff. Batman had toned down the violence. He stopped killing people. They brought in Robin to kind of tone down the violence, but also to bring in an appeal for younger readers. So there was a lot of editorial control at DC, and Simon and Kirby were just told, do what you want. First thing they did was they revamped The Sandman. Now, before they did it, if you've ever read Sandman Mystery Theater, the Golden Age Sandman, he was more like the Shadow than a superhero. His mask was basically a gas mask, and he had a gas gun that would shoot knockout gas. His costume was actually a long trench coat, a hat, and a gas mask. And it was very atmospheric, moving, moody, mystery-type stories. Simon and Kirby came in. They gave them tights, gave them a sidekick named Sandy, and it was Simon and Kirby adventure stories. Both have their merits, and I love what was done with Sandman Mystery Theater, but those pre-Simon and Kirby Sandman stories are unreadable now. The drawings are crude. The stories are boring. You can't read it unless you're a true Golden Age aficionado. Simon and Kirby came in, boom, action, fast-moving plots, interesting villains, Kirby's hyperkinetic art. It's like night and day. At the same time, they were going to cancel the character Manhunter and wanted Simon and Kirby to replace Manhunter with something. Joe Simon said that he loved the name Manhunter so much, they said, no, we're going to keep the name. And again, they completely changed the character, turned it into a Simon and Kirby type character. They did another kid gang book called Boy Commandos. And that was in July of 1942. Now, they'd done The Young Allies, which was Bucky and Toro and a bunch of kind of stereotypical kids fighting the Nazis. So Boy Commandos was sort of the same thing. I haven't read a lot of the stories because they have not been in print, but I've seen drawings of it, and it's very much the Kirby kid gang, where he picks different ethnicities and different types. And yep, there's always the scrappy Brooklyn short brawler kid, and they were involved in fighting the war over in Europe. That was such a huge success that they did another one. And it started as a feature in one of the other books, and it soon got its own book. And it was selling over 1 million copies a month. It was so big that they did a home front kid gang team called the Newsboy Legion, and that was in Star Spangled Comics, which they had a kind of a superhero mentor called the Guardian. Kirby later revived the Newsboy Legion when he got to the New Gods in the 70s. And while it wasn't as big a hit, it's still a lot of fun. Now, because they revived the Newsboy Legion in the 70s, they reprinted some of the stories from the 40s. And those I've read, and it's very much the Kirby, everybody's got a distinct personality. Everybody has a specific look. Everybody's a different ethnicity. They're all friends, and They're all in, it's hyperkinetic action all again. So at this time, this was 1942, Kirby's life is going pretty good. But they also know that war is coming. And Kirby was already a rapid artist. He would draw and draw and draw and draw. But he was drawing at night in order to get ahead because he knew he was going to be drafted soon. So he wanted to, he and Joe Simon wanted to have a backstock so that while they were, if they got drafted, National would still have Simon and Kirby stuff to publish, keeping their name out there. Simon and Kirby were making a lot of money. They were busy all the time. They were really in demand at National. And then, May 23rd, 1942, he married Roz Goldstein. She had just turned 18, so it was legal for them to get married. Roz's parents approved. They got married. At the same time, Jack changed his name legally from Katzberg to Jack Kirby. Now, with World War II underway, Leibowitz expected that Simon Kirby would be drafted. They expected that they would be drafted. So Simon and Kirby hired writers, anchors, letterers, artists to help create a year's worth of material. They would do all the stuff, and Simon and Kirby would do the penciling. Then they would hand it off to somebody else to ink it, somebody else to do this. Simon got other people to write the stories. He would go over them to make sure they had the proper feel. Kirby would draw them. Simon would help with the art. And then it would get shipped off. And they build up an inventory. So 1942, he's making a fortune. He just got married. He's really kind of the big star. Simon and Kirby were the rock stars of comic books. But remember, they were kind of in their own world, and they were the pets of the publisher. The other editors at National, not big fans. Mort Weisinger was already working at DC. And we'll talk a lot about Weisinger as we go on, as we do more episodes. But Weisinger would run them down. Their art's crude. Their stories, they don't really have stories. It's just fight scenes. The inking looks like somebody just threw ink on a page. He would run them down every chance he got, because he was working with Superman. He was working with the Prestige books. Well, the stuff we do is far better than what Simon and Kirby did, even though Simon and Kirby's stuff sold as well, if not better. June 7th, 1943, Jack Kirby was drafted. He did basic training at Camp Stewart near Savannah, Georgia. He was in the 7th Infantry Regiment. He was initially assigned to the motor pool, but Kirby was pretty horrible at driving, so they moved him to infantry. And then he landed on Omaha Beach in Normandy on August 23rd, 1944, 2.5 months after D-Day. He had been in the military almost a year. They had almost run out of all the inventory. He was drawing when he could and sending stuff back. Joe Simon also was drafted. He was doing the same thing. They had someone running their studio. And they were involved in World War II, and I think that's as good a place as any to stop. I've received a few questions about Jack Kirby that I will answer. First one is a question that I've got a few times, because I've said for, gosh, almost a year, I was going to do a special Kirby episode, and I was asked, other than the cover of Amazing Fantasy 15, did Jack Kirby draw Spider-Man? And the answer is yes. He drew Spider-Man a few times. The most memorable was Strange Tales Annual Number 2, which was the Human Torch meeting Spider-Man. And it kind of started the whole friendly rivalry between the two. Yeah, they'd done hints of it. Strange Tales was where the Human Torch solo stories were. Let's see.
I'm so glad I'm going to be editing this. Oh, come on. Firefox sucks so hard. So in it you get Jack Kirby drawing Spider-Man, and you can see why Stan Lee decided to go with Steve Ditko. His Spider-Man didn't look like a kid. It looked like a full-grown adult. It was kind of bulky, kind of that Kirby design. There are also some posters and promotional stuff that Kirby drew with Spider-Man. And I don't think Kirby ever really got Spider-Man the way we think of Spider-Man. I'm not saying that he did a bad job. But when you think Spider-Man, especially when you think Spider-Man in the 60s, you think the way Steve Ditko drew him. Now, the good thing about it was Stan Lee, who was very much thought of the characters needed to look like the way the artist drew them, he had Kirby draw it because Kirby was the Human Torch guy, was the Fantastic Four guy. He'd done the cover of Amazing Fantasy 15, but he had Steve Ditko ink it. So it's another of the early collaborations between Kirby and Ditko. So Ditko kind of helped in making Spider-Man look the way Spider-Man did in the other books, but you still had that Kirby feel. Kirby didn't do the kind of odd spidery poses that Ditko did. He did the standard heroic poses. And for the most part, he didn't draw Spider-Man that much. There were, like I said, some promotional posters, but this is really the only Spider-Man story that Jack Kirby drew. The last comic book Jack Kirby drew. Now, that one gets a little messy. There's an official last Jack Kirby book that's called Last of the Viking Heroes, but it was mostly done by Mark Thibodeau. I'm going to put the spelling up. I've never heard the name pronounced. But when I look at it, it's very much one of the things Kirby did through the late 70s and early 80s. He would draw up ideas because he was working for animation studios and other places. And he would basically draw up ideas for pitch meetings. He would draw up characters for the pitch meetings. And this is one of those where he kind of half drew a pitch story. And it was finished by the inker. When I look at it, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't look like Kirby. It looks more like the inker. When I think last Kirby story, I think The Hunger Dogs. It was the New Gods graphic novel that came out in 1985. It was fully drawn by Kirby. It had some... Greg Theakson did some wonderful inking that made it look almost like paintings. And while there were things published after that, Kirby, after Hunger Dogs, kind of stepped back from doing art because he was having health problems, he was having vision problems, there are other things. He had had a heart attack in the late 70s, early 80s. There have also been stories that Kirby had a stroke in the late 70s, early 80s that no one in the family will confirm, but people who knew him or worked with him, they felt that that he had a stroke. In Evanier's book, he said he had a very mild stroke that didn't affect him. However, there are other people who said that the stroke did affect him, that he had some trouble recovering from it. When you look at his art in the 80s, while it's still Kirby art, you could see that his vision problems were affecting it. So while there's the official Last of the Viking Heroes, the Image put out, or it was a crossover with Phantom Force, which was another, hey, let's take a Kirby idea and make a comic out of it. If you really want the last thing that Kirby sat down and drew as something that would be published under his name, it's Hunger Dogs. Marvel did a series based on some Kirby stuff. It had also some of the, you know, he drew a few pages to kind of pitch the character. None of that stuff really works as Kirby to me, because it's very clear that it's after the fact, after Kirby was done drawing, somebody took his old stuff and just kind of reworked it. So if you're looking for the last Kirby book, you're going to want to pick up The Hunger Dogs, which is available in the fourth volume of the four-volume New Gods books. I was asked what my favorite Kirby story was, which is a question that's actually kept me from doing this podcast for a while, because it's so hard for me to go, well, this is the best story Kirby ever did. Jack Kirby said that the best story he ever did was issue 3 of Boys Ranch, which was published in the 50s, called Mother Delilah. And there are a lot of other creators who point to that as their favorite Kirby story. Marv Wolfman was the first person I ever heard talk about it. And it was at the Chicago Comic Con, same one, where somebody asked him what his favorite comic was. And he started talking about Mother Delilah and how he read it as a kid and how that comic meant so much to him. I have read it, and while it's a good story, and I understand why people who read it at the time loved it so much, it's not my favorite Kirby story. I've narrowed it down. One of them is Fantastic Four 51, This Man, This Monster, which has probably the best drawing of the Thing ever on the front page. And it's just the Thing standing in the rain. The fabulous Fantastic Four must solve the riddle of This Man, This Monster. And not to spoil the story too much, it's available in the Essential Fantastic Four number 3, Marvel Masterwork number 5. Is it 5? Yeah, Marvel Masterwork, either number 5 or 6. I can't remember which. The Thing is depressed after the end of the Galactus trilogy, because he feels that Alicia has left him for the Silver Surfer. And why should Alicia be with him anyway? Because he's a misshapen, grotesque monster. He is taken in by a scientist who's unbelievably jealous of Reed Richards, who has a machine, and he is able to take the body of the Thing. And the scientist is going to go prove that Reed Richards is a fraud, and as he is working with Reed Richards as the Thing, he realizes that Reed Richards isn't a fraud, he's not a glory hound, that he does all these wonderful things and all these charitable things without telling the world, and he sacrifices himself to save Reed Richards from death. And the art throughout, it's not just the action, but the emotion and the pathos that he's able to bring to the drawing. When I look at this splash page, which is actually reprinted from the original art in the Kirby book on page 146. Just this drawing. You've got Kirby's machinery. You've got the Thing just standing there in the rain. And it evokes that emotional feel where, you know, and I can imagine at the time, you're reading the Fantastic Four. You've read the Galactus story, which is this huge story at the time. And then the next issue, there's the Thing just standing there, and it's a complete mood shift and utterly different. The two other stories that I was able to narrow it down to were both in The New Gods. And the first one is The Pact, which tells the story of the history of the New Gods. Why was Orion being raised by the New Gods? Darkseid's son, Orion, being raised by the New Gods, and Highfather's son, Mr. Miracle, was being raised by Darkseid. And it goes into the history of why basically the origin of the conflict, why all these things were set up, and it's mythology. Kirby, in the New Gods, he's creating mythology. This isn't a standard superhero story. This isn't just another comic book. He's telling the story of gods, a new mythology for that time. And then the other story that is one of my favorites, and I actually will reread it, and I think it's got one of Kirby's best pages, and that is The Glory Boat. And the story starts with a father and a son, and the father is very much the old, he's old, he's stuck in his ways, he's kind of bigoted, and the son is trying to, they're on a boat, and the son is trying to tell him, no, this is, it's a new world, we're trying to change things, we're not being disrespectful, we're trying to have a new world. And they get caught up in the conflict between the gods. And I'm just going to read what it says on this page. And it's the Darkseid's minions are preparing to attack. And Orion and Lightray of the New Gods have put together a weapon to go after them with. And the page is just the weapon with Lightray on top screaming, if we must die, let New Genesis live. And Orion is riding alongside saying, if we go to the source, you demons go with us. The top of the page. As if in answer to its attacker, the wooden shift blasts open, and something inside rushes out to the calamitous night, singing and shining and sleek and deadly. What Lightray has imprinted on the life cube is now fully grown, and it carries the glistening warhead of the living, the dead, the fiery trumpets of the source. And you read this page, and it, you've been to a movie where it's the big ending, and you just get that big explosion and emotion, and everything is there, and doesn't even have to be 3D. It feels like you're in it, you're part of it. Kirby was able to do that all the time, but on this page, the build-up, and especially if you've been reading everything up to then, the frustration of we're fighting Darkseid and we're not able to get any victories, this is the first major victory. And it ends with the father mourning his son who has sacrificed himself so that other people can live, showing the father that he has been wrong, and in being wrong, his mind is broken. It's all of Kirby's different ideas and thoughts, and the way he thought that the youth of the world were the important thing because that's where the new ideas came from. And he was always drawn to that. Just all of his philosophy and the energy and excitement just encapsulated in that one comic book. Now, Kirby did other stories that are fantastic. He did stories that run the gamut, but those three are my favorite. Let's see. I had one more. One more question. Oh. When I was a kid, I bought as many comics as I could get. I had a babysitter who would give me her boyfriend, later husband's comics when he was done reading them. But then on the bus, we would trade. So how did I get most of my early Kirby comics? I traded for them. I would trade the stuff that I'd read. And the other two kids I traded comics with on the bus, they didn't like Jack Kirby. Oh, I don't like it. He draws square fingers and everything's got squiggles on it and his machines look weird. I don't like Kirby stuff. So I was actually able to trade one comic for two Kirby comics. And I was giddy. I wasn't going to argue with them. I'm getting two Kirby comics for the price of one regular comic. That's stuff that I couldn't find because when I would go to the newsstand, mom and dad would give me money to buy comics. First thing I would do, I would look to see, was it drawn by Kirby? Okay, it's not drawn by Kirby. I'd get the Kirby books off the stand. And then it would be, okay, then I would look, is this story continued? Because if it's continued, not going to get it. I don't know if I'll get the next part. But the Kirby stuff, I didn't care if it was continued or not, because you always felt like you got a complete story when you read a Kirby book. Yeah, it might be continued into the next book, but it was more, oh yeah, here's something at the end to get you to buy the next one. It was very rare that a Kirby story would completely continue. So that's how I got a lot of my really early Kirby stuff. There was also the reprints that came out, and I was big into the reprints because even as a kid, it's, oh, I want to know where all this stuff came from. I want to know the history of this stuff. How long has the Fantastic Four been around? How long has Spider-Man been around? Yeah, what's going on with Thor? So there you go. That's part one. I do not know how many parts there will be. I've talked for about an hour and a half, but it's going to be cut down to about an hour, hour and 10 minutes, because, yeah. I've got pauses where I look stuff up and coughing and sniffling and. But I've talked this far and I've only got up to 1943 to 1944. So this isn't going to be. Part two comes next week. It'll be kind of an irregular series because I've got other things I'm going to be doing. But again, I welcome your feedback. I welcome your questions. If you send me a question, I will do my level best to answer it, whether if it's a factual question. Those take some research. If it's my opinion, I could give my opinion for hours. And I probably will. So I want to thank you for listening. Again, the email address is corey.strode@gmail.com. If you would like to advertise on Solitaire Rose Radio, let's say you've got a podcast that you want my fans. Okay, my listeners. Okay, the people who download the podcast. If you want them to know about, shoot me an email. We'll work something out. If you want to advertise a book coming out, a web page, anything, go ahead, email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. Subject, advertising. Now, last time, I tried to have a witty closer, and I didn't much care for it. I think a comic book podcast, or really any sort of podcast, needs to have a closer. Needs to have something where at the end of the episode you got a nice, cute little saying. So I'm going to try out a few. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you at the bar. Okay, that's not going to work because I don't drink that much anymore. Okay, thanks for listening, and I'm going to go eat pie. Pie. We'll be right back.